Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's Friday, and time for our Week in Review. Another week, another massive failure in the state's vaccine rollout. While the overall vaccination rate is improving, Governor Charlie Baker acknowledges the website for booking appointments isn't working well.
My hair's on fire. I can't even begin to tell you how pissed off I am. This is not satisfactory. It's not even, it's awful, and it's going to get fixed. And I'm going to work very hard to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Baker speaking with our friends at GBH, and our own WBUR voices share in the frustration.
I got the website crashed message again on my screen, so I guess like everybody else, I got to be patient and try later.
It's very frustrating, and I'm thinking, who's in charge here? I mean, it's just been a phenomenal mess in a state that's supposed to be really smart.
WBUR's Bob Oakes there, and Radio Boston caller Alma. Now the legislature is planning oversight hearings, so what's the fallout? Oh, and speaking of fallout, former President Donald Trump was impeached for his role in last month's insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, but the Senate acquitted him. Congressman Jake Auchincloss says that may not be the end.
We have paths forward in what Congress can still do to prohibit President Trump from running for office again. That's an issue of national security, but it's also about representing that nobody is above the law.
So it's been a week of accountability, or perhaps lack thereof. Lots to cover, so we turn to our panelists. Renee Landers joins us. She's a professor of law and director of the health law concentration at Suffolk University. Renee, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Jim Sturgis, executive director of the right-leaning Pioneer Institute. Jim, always good to have you along.
Nice to be with you.
And listeners, we're starting with the vaccine rollout and who should bear the blame for how it's going here in Massachusetts. Give us a call with your experiences, thoughts, analysis. Join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. All right, Jim, Renee, just want to get your reactions to the state's vaccine appointment site crashing yesterday. Renee, why don't you lead us off?
Well, I think it's obviously a tragedy because one way to address all of the disruption of the pandemic and to protect people's health is for the maximum number of people to be vaccinated as possible. And if the website crashing, really interferes with people's ability to, you know, take this public health precaution and then to enable the whole population to get back on a more sound public health and economic footing after, you know, the pandemic is less prevalent in the community.
Sure, the stakes are a little higher, right, than having like the RMV website crash or something. I mean, Jim, what was your reaction?
Yeah, no, the stakes are much higher. And Callum, I think, is that we all know the state and frankly the federal government are terrible at technology procurement. Where there's a trial court in the early 2000s, $75 million for a case management system that didn't work. The federal government's own rollout of the Affordable Care Act website, the state's own rollout of the Affordable Care Act website here, $250 million, didn't work. The FBI got involved because of malfeasance. The MBTA's current Cubic contract for the automated fare collection system, now another $200 million. It's above $1 billion for procurement there. One thing, one cause here is that government's not good at this because when you're working with private vendors, and I'm a proponent of being smart and working with private vendors because they can add a lot of value, but it means you have to have in public service really talented managers who can provide clear rules of the road, you know, and stick to it. The second cause I think here is there's some old-fashioned stuff that I think we just kind of forgotten about. Look, in the olden days when we did distribute vaccines, we did things like, you know, each day A through E, last name, you know, five by five letters. And the next day, you know, F through J. It distributed the number of people who were trying to get through any system. That was pre-technology. With technology and a new system that we haven't actually tested well enough, to throw 1 million people at it is unwise, I think. There are lots of questions about this whole rollout, including why we leaned so heavily on websites for the elderly in the first place, who are not as equipped. They've not had that experience. So there's a lot to question here.
All right, we're going to get to some of those questions as we go along, but listeners, we'd love for you to join the conversation. Again, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We heard from plenty of you yesterday, including Peter in Newbury.
Well, I was on for about from 7:55 a.m. until about noontime, and it was incredibly frustrating. I mean, this is a system that is completely upside down. I just don't understand.
Okay, so Peter doesn't understand. So in an effort to understand, Radio Boston spoke with Mani Sundaram. He's the chief information officer at Akamai Technologies. And he says it seems like the state didn't properly predict or prepare for what he calls the flash crowd that tried to access the site yesterday morning.
You need to know what your peak loads are going to be. You need to make sure that you have the infrastructure ready to handle that. And, you know, with the advent of cloud providers and so on, some of that stuff has actually become easier. But it still means that there's plenty of prep work that needs to happen to make sure that the websites are scalable.
Okay, so Jim, my question is, why wasn't that prep work done? I mean, the good management thing is supposed to be Charlie Baker's calling card, right? He's the CEO governor. He ran your institute, Pioneer. He ran Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare. What is going on?
Well, he ran our institute a long time ago, Callum, before we got really good at management. How's that? No, I'm joking.
There's the stiff arm.
No, look, I think anyone who looks at this objectively would say that if anyone said that we would be outclassed by West Virginia in the distribution of vaccines, we would have all said, you're crazy. We have among the best healthcare institutions in the country right here in Massachusetts. If anyone said back in December, if you watch the news closely, that we would be scrambling to find nurses or people who were preparing to become nurses in sufficient numbers so that we could actually do the injections we need to do, that we're still scrambling to do that, says that we were not organized the way that we were supposed to. And I would say that some of this is has to fall squarely at the feet of the Health and Human Services office, where I believe that the people running are fantastic people. They're very good at mental health, behavioral health, human services, but that does not translate to this emergency situation. This is a situation that requires crazy focus on testing things out and avoiding trying to do too much at the same time. And I'll just give you just a quick example. I've not understood, honestly, the logic behind trying to be so fine-grained in terms of who we have come through the distribution channels. I mean, I've always thought about it in two very simple blocks. One is by age, a little bit like Florida, but then complementing that with a targeted approach that goes to geographies that have been hardest hit, like Roxbury and Chelsea, who would not, I mean, in Roxbury, the average life expectancy for a man living in Roxbury is about 60 years of age. So an age distribution would not work for that. But you go there because it's
right,
much
and a big gap relative to what you see in Back Bay, for example. And that's certainly one of the factors in this. It's a good point, Jim. And I want to bring some of our callers in, too.
Go ahead.
Well, just let me pause you there for a moment, Jim, because I want to bring in some of the callers,
please,
too, and then we'll pick that up on the other side. But Andrew has been waiting patiently in West Roxbury. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hey, how are you doing? Thanks for taking my call. This is really important for people to hear. The failure of this website is technically almost identical to the way that Ticketmaster's website failed during the on sale for a really high demand concert. I have been getting into sold out shows my entire life, and I used the same trick to get both of my parents registered. Yesterday, the first 65-year-olds were able to get on. I have had tons of people asking me out, and if you'd be willing to give me a bit of...
Andrew, I'm going to take it back from you because you're breaking up on us, but I get your point about sort of using other websites. We've heard other states resorting to using Eventbrite, for example, to try to schedule these vaccine appointments because they've been having their own trouble. Let's get to another caller at it, though. Renee, go ahead, Renee, and then we'll come.
No,
Cynthia,
I
hold
was
on
just
one
going
sec.
To
we'll
say
get to
that
you. Go ahead, Renee.
I'm glad that the last caller pointed out that this isn't just a problem that government has sometimes with high-demand services. I think Target has had in the past these problems when it has a new designer's, you know, set of products coming online, and the website was not able to handle the, you know, instantaneous demand, you know, for access at that point. I'm not excusing it at all, but I don't think it's government only.
Yeah, yeah, it is hard. I think that's a good point. And certainly private sector has had the same troubles. But the Ticketmaster example, it's sort of apples and oranges, though, because, I mean, concert tickets, I mean, it's to your point earlier, Renee, I mean, we're talking about lives here. That's just right. Higher stakes. And so I'm wondering, I mean, it sometimes feels like the governor is Teflon Charlie, right? I mean, this he hasn't been dinged up by trouble with the MBTA or the state police or the Registry of Motor Vehicles. I mean, is this one going to stick to him?
Well, obviously, the impact of it is more widespread and much more visible to the public. So it's hard to predict because, you know, there is some period of time between now and the next election, and the public sometimes tends to forget if things improve and things start to go better.
All right, let's get to a couple more callers. Cynthia is in Cambridge. Go ahead, Cynthia.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to mention something that's really bothered me the last 24 hours, which is that it's bad enough that the state website crashed, but that's almost predictable. But what really bothers me is the almost predatory data mining practices of some of these vendors. They're just being hugely opportunistic. If you go to look for a vaccine at a Walgreens, you have to sign up for a Walgreens account, and they automatically opt you into every marketing email before they tell you they have nothing. Then I went to two other sites, and I had to give all my personal information, including my health care coverage, to be told they had nothing. So I wish somebody would address that, because they should, if you understand screening you to qualify, but I don't really understand the rest of it.
Yeah, Cynthia, it's a good question. Thanks for raising those points. Nancy is in Framingham. What was your experience?
Yes, I had a positive experience earlier in the month. I'm a 75-year-old on dialysis. On February 2nd, I received a voicemail from my primary care's office where other physicians practice, and the Moderna vaccine was available on a first-come, first-served basis. I signed up immediately for an appointment. My 67-year-old companion in PCA qualified also for the Moderna vaccine because he cares for me. So the next day, on Wednesday, I think it was the 3rd of March, 3rd of February, we went in, got our vaccines. We had a ball getting them, and we're scheduled to go back for our second vaccines on March 3rd.
Got it. Nancy, thank you for the ring. So I'm glad you had a good experience. And I do want to give credit where it is due. I mean, Massachusetts does rank among the top 10 states when it comes to vaccinations per capita. But inequality is a persistent problem here. I mean, Renee, the newly formed Vaccine Equity Now Coalition this week, this is lawmakers and public health experts, says white residents have received 12 times more doses than black residents and 16 times more doses than Latinx residents.
Well, I think the point that Jim made earlier is an important one, that you know, some of the early screens for who would become eligible right away for the vaccines didn't take into account some of the, you know, sort of structural disparities, the lower ages of the lower life expectancy and lower ages of some of the people of color, the communities of color in the state, and also the accessibility websites, accessibility sites, so that, you know, the people would have access, convenient access in their communities. And that's where having a slightly more decentralized distribution effort might have been more effective. You know, you don't have to have people come all the way across town from, say, Charlestown to, you know, Fenway Park. Maybe there is something at the community health center located in the community where people can go and get the vaccine. And so I think that often, you know, the equity is can be somewhat of an afterthought. And in this circumstance, it sort of has exacerbated the pre-existing inequities in the exposure to the vaccine, and then the economic disparities in being able to, you know, take advantage of opportunities that do exist.
Well, and on this point, we discussed this yesterday on the program with State Representative Sonia Chang Diaz. She is part of the Vaccine Equity Now Coalition, and she was talking about the Baker administration's new equity initiative, which is separate. And she says it's short on specifics, and the state still has a lot to improve in this area.
I share the analysis of many others in the state that the rollout thus far has been a, to put it mildly, a very frustrating affair and a tragedy and an embarrassment for the state. We have lagged behind other states in overall rollout, and we are worsening racial inequities rather than making them better.
So, Jim Sturgis, did you have anything you wanted to add on that point?
No, I think, look, the only thing I would add is some of what we've done by targeting specific populations, and this may be controversial to say, but even in the healthcare space, if we were focused on nurses, and people who are directly working with COVID patients, I think it would have been better than taking this sort of carte blanche approach to it. And that does affect also the equity issue, because so many of our nurses and direct service healthcare workers are of color. So I think it would have been helpful to do that as well. I also just wanted to underscore the point that the prevalence argument is one where whether it's Chelsea or Roxbury, we're just seeing a lot more cases there. So it's not just even counting people by race, but it's just looking at where the virus wants to live and trying to address that.
All right, let's bring in a couple more callers. Sam is in East Greenwich. Go ahead, Sam.
Hello. There are two things that really get me. One is the simple fact that when they decided to lower the age in one fell swoop from 75 to 65. They obviously have not been hearing all the rapping about baby boomers for the last 75 years. I'm 74 and 11 months, and I just, after struggling here in Rhode Island, managed to get an appointment for my first shot yesterday. The shot is going to be this Wednesday. But my wife, who is 75, and due to medical conditions, simply could not navigate getting a shot on her own. But she got hers yesterday, and I had to take her there and take her through the whole process. And there I was with my arm all ready. And you would think that they would, for health, for public health logistic purposes, just go ahead and take care of me there. But I think it would have been wise to take the age down to 70 first, and they wouldn't have been quite overwhelmed by taking it all the way down to 65. Due to that huge bulge in the baby boom generation that started in 1952 or so.
Sam, I'm going to pause you there, but I think it's a good point. And what you see there, I think, in Sam's anecdote is that sort of inconsistency. Sometimes we see the companion who's bringing somebody for a vaccine get the shot. Sometimes we don't. All right. Glenn is in Maynard. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yes. I knew this was going to happen. I slept in that morning and didn't even turn on my computer because I figured out that it was going to crash, and when I saw the news, I was not surprised. And I believe it's due to a fundamentally incompatibility between government and information technology. When you look at government, it's hierarchically organized. It's slow on purpose. It's designed for a world where people had to travel by horse and buggy to the state house to meet and to make decisions. And contrast that to the information technology world, which is agile, it's adaptable, it's fast, and it's networked organized. These two entities are so different from each other that it's...
Yeah, I got it, Glenn. Okay, that's a good point. There is a sort of fundamental incompatibility there. And so, Renee, Glenn is making me, you know, wonder about the challenge here. Maybe we're asking too much of government. I mean, let me ask you, you're a lawyer, but you've also spent a lot of time in the healthcare world. I mean, you were a deputy general counsel for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. You're a trustee at Mass General. You understand the public health challenge here better than most. So as we're scrutinizing the vaccine rollout, maybe we're not fully appreciating how hard this is.
Well, it is a hard thing. I think that's really good that you made this point. And but I will say this, that it would have been less hard if there had been investment in the public health infrastructure all along, that it would have allowed, earlier recognition that the virus was about, around and about, Earlier opportunities for intervention to prevent the spread of the virus. And then finally, have, you know, laid the infrastructure, prepared the infrastructure for being able to respond, you know, with the vaccine rollout and all these things. So I think at the very beginning of the pandemic, there was a lot of news, a lot of information in the news about the, in the last decade or so, of the tremendous underinvestment in public health resources. And I think that we're paying the price for that now, because you can't just, you know, roll out these complicated systems, on a dime, you know? And so you need, to have the platforms available so that when the crisis occurs, one can, move into action. And that hasn't happened. I also wanted to go back to the other point that the caller from Cambridge made about the, one of the professors at MIT has written a book called Surveillance Capitalism. And
sure. Go ahead, Renee. We're coming up on a break, but go ahead. Yeah, go ahead real
yeah,
quick.
Yeah, no, anyway, so I just want to, I think that that's a really important issue, that this inability or refusal to regulate the collection of information by these private parties is actually a concerning aspect. And, you know, I think that the, you know, drugstore chains of the world are probably taking advantage of this situation in order to collect more data on populations.
We're going to talk about local politics in the context of this vaccine rollout. We're going to be talking about racial inequality and city contracting as well, vaccine distribution, how it all plays into the nascent governors and mayoral races. Everything in local politics is on the table here. 1-800-423-8255 is the number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jim, Renee, you know, the state legislature is going to hold its first oversight hearing next Thursday to probe this shaky vaccine rollout. And the lawmakers want Governor Baker and Health and Human Services Secretary Mary Lou Sutters to come and testify. Now, it's unclear whether they'll show. Jim, what are your expectations for this hearing?
I think my expectations for the hearing is that we're going to have a laundry list of things that went wrong. I hope we do also have some focus on what has gone right. And I would say just to listeners, feels like a dark show, and for many reasons it should be, given the failures. But I would note that across the country, the cases are down 77% over the past six weeks. That's true in California, Florida, elsewhere, which suggests that something is happening because of the vaccinations and also because of perhaps some level of herd immunity that's developing because of people actually getting it. So, you know, I hope
and maybe coming down off of the holiday surges, though, too, Jim. Right? I mean, that was part of the trouble too. There was those surges right around Christmas and New Year's, and so maybe we're you know, coming down off of that a little bit as well.
Absolutely. So, but I do think people are going to take a look at everything from nursing homes and the infection rates that were there and what was preventable, how people acted. And we've already been through some of that through the soldiers' homes and other investigations. I think they'll be taking a look at testing, not so much, but some. And they will absolutely be looking at the website crash. They'll look at all the things that are happening now. I think they're going to take a broad look at the response from the Baker administration.
So there's going to be the scrutiny from state lawmakers on Beacon Hill. But this week, we also saw 10 members of our congressional delegation signing a letter urging the Baker administration to create a system that would allow people to pre-register and then get a notification for vaccine appointments. Senator Elizabeth Warren was one of those signatories, and we had her on the show a couple days ago. She offered this appraisal of Baker's overall performance.
I think the governor has made good decisions to try to make sure that these vaccines are equitably distributed and that they go to hard to reach communities. But that still doesn't explain why we weren't using the vaccines that were allocated to us, why we weren't moving them through the system fast. You know, it's possible to do both.
So, Renee Landers, I mean, I'd call that relatively mild criticism from Senator Warren, but still, it's rare to hear our federal lawmakers speaking out against the governor.
Well, I would agree that Senator Warren's criticism was mild. You know, I think she's pointing out the obvious fact that every jurisdiction in the world and every jurisdiction in the United States has struggled in its response to this pandemic. I mean, you know, with the possible exception of, you know, places like New Zealand. And so, you know, you can't, you know, judge, you know, everyone too harshly in that in, against a challenge like this. On the other hand, I would just go back to my earlier point, and it would reinforce, you know, some of the issues that Jim highlighted that the legislature might consider. All of these things like early capacity for testing, you know, surveillance in congregate living situations like nursing homes and other kinds of facilities like that, prisons. All of that speaks to the absence of the healthcare infrastructure to get an early warning that something is going wrong and that interventions are necessary. And I hope that the legislative hearing will focus on solutions, you know, how to avoid the problems that occurred in the future, because I kind of agree that it doesn't really serve any particular purpose other than a political purpose to start casting blame right at this moment.
Sure. So if you want to join the conversation, again, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tony is in Hamilton. Go ahead, Tony.
Hey, how's it going? I was trying to point out a couple of the problems with the signing up process. I have tons of friends and people who are in their late 20s who are able to sign up over a month ago when the first responders were, basically saying that they worked for a group home or they volunteered somewhere, which they did not. A lot of these people are in the restaurant industry, and, you know, a couple of them work for the cruise lines, and they were just trying to skip the line, basically. But, I mean, recently, as of last weekend, it happened once again. The center locally here that was giving out the vaccine had more than 50%, well under 75, that were able to check off the volunteer box on the website and were not asked for any identification or proof, just an ID.
Well, so Tony, let me ask you then, like, what's your, so that's an interesting observation, Tony. What's your take on that, though? Because the counter to that criticism would be, well, listen, even if it's sort of a leaky fence there, if it gets us to herd immunity faster, vaccination is a good vaccination.
I get that. And just, firsthand, just being in the parking lot of one of the situations where, one of my friends was going in to get his, and, you know, being 35, there was a couple walking up to the door asking if they could get an extra vaccine, and they were basically turned away, and they were older. They were 75, 77. They were told to go home while a healthy 35-year-old walked in and got their vaccine. So, I mean, if they're just going to open it up and tell you to lie about it, then I guess it's open free game for everybody.
Yeah. All right. Well, Tony, thanks for the ring. So there's an interesting point there, Jim. I mean, there is this sort of debate between, you know, herd immunity versus, you know, really just being tightly enforcing, you know, the requirements for the age. And this is something that will probably come up, you know, in the governor's race next year. Now, Baker hasn't said whether he's going to seek a third term, but if he does run for reelection, do you think the way that he's managed the pandemic overall is going to ultimately help or hurt him?
I think it turns on two things. First one is it obviously could put a big dent in his brand of being a highly competent manager. I still do think there is time to turn that around. They were making some progress, but I think, for example, things that are outside of his control, like the delivery of vaccines that seem to have been held up at this point, these things could slow him down, slow the administration down in the distribution of vaccines. So I think that May or June are important dates if it's able to be turned around by then. And that's simply because I think anybody who's going to run for governor kind of has to decide by that time if they're going to start doing the fundraising and all that other stuff that they do. The second thing, and I think is the most important, is I think the biggest issue between now and November 2022 is, will people get back to work? We have hundreds of thousands of people who are not at work. Will they be able to go back and get their jobs? Will new businesses be created? Will the ones that were existing before, will they continue to survive? Will they die? I mean, these are really important things to people's livelihoods. And I think from here through 2022, I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get the vaccination right. So I'm assuming that's going to happen. But after that, it's all about what happens in the economy, I think, because people need jobs.
As somebody once said, it's the economy is stupid, right? I do want to make a turn here. And Renee Landers, I'm going to come to you. I do, before we could fill the whole show talking about the political implications of the vaccines. But before the segment gets away from us, I do want to take note that this week, the Democratic Party in Massachusetts, and really the whole state, lost an icon. Doris Bunty died at 87. And she was the first Black woman elected to the state legislature in 1972. And we had former State Representative Marie St. Flour on the show with us. And she told us this week that Bunty was a mentor, smart, tenacious, and somebody who worked to build consensus.
She was firm. She knew where she wanted to go. And she left the table always with the door open. That I learned from her. I really did. And so I appreciate her modeling that for me, and I think others.
So Renee Landers, what is Doris Bunty's legacy, you think?
Well, she was a tremendous pathbreaker. Unfortunately, we're still living in a society where there are a lot of firsts in terms of women, people of color, you know, other kinds of people who haven't traditionally been represented in the, you know, halls of power, like state legislatures, corporations. And she was really the kind of pathbreaker, as former Representative St. Flour noted, who, left a legacy of accomplishment and collaboration, a collaborative style that allowed her to be successful. And then also, left a ladder down for other people to follow in her footsteps. And, you know, we certainly have a more diverse legislature now than the one she entered, more diversity in all kinds of areas of the society right now. And I think that, visible leaders like Doris Bunty really do provide inspiration and examples for people to follow in their footsteps.
Well, you know, I mean, we do have a more diverse state legislature in many ways, but I will say that Bunty's passing, you know, is a moment to take stock of that, right, of diversity on Beacon right. Hill. And I looked at the numbers, and you know, when she helped create the Massachusetts Black Legislative Caucus in 1973 as a freshman, there were 7 members of the caucus. It's now the Massachusetts Black and Latino Legislative Caucus, but there are just 8 members who identify as Black. So, I mean, granted, there are slightly fewer total seats in the legislature today than there were in 1973. But Jim Sturgis, that doesn't seem like a whole lot of progress in almost 5 decades from 7 to 8.
You know, before today's show, I looked up the same numbers and I said to myself the very same thing, which is we obviously have made lots of progress. And I think her legacy is one of starting that conversation, being elected as someone who is from the community and having her voice be heard in a way that I think Marie's absolutely right about. But the other one is really important. She left a legacy of actual accomplishment, as Renee said, which is things like desegregating public housing, being a big part of establishing Roxbury Community College. These are institutions that matter a great deal, and these are changes that matter a great deal. So I completely take the point, but I also would note that she did leave a lasting legacy that is countable, is measurable.
Yeah, and what you're referring to is something I didn't even mention, that besides being the first Black woman elected to the legislature, she was also the first Black woman to head the Boston Housing Authority after that. But on this subject of diversity, you know, this week we also saw a trio of civil rights groups sue the city of Boston over what they claim are discriminatory practices in public contracting. And the city's self-reported numbers are alarming on this measure. I mean, in a 6-year period, only about 1% out of $2.2 billion in city contracts went to Black and Latinx-owned businesses. And WBUR talked about this with Segun Adowu. He heads the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts, which is the lead plaintiff in this suit.
The retort that we have often heard from this city, from the Walsh administration, and from many detractors, is that Black and other minority-owned businesses cannot be found, or that we're not ready, or that we're not fit to do the job. But this report, which the city commissioned, paints a very different picture.
So Adobo says the report shows almost 7% of all Black and Latinx-owned businesses are qualified to fulfill city contracts, and that if the city had been more proactive, it could have steered another $76 million to those businesses. So Renee Landers, I mean, what does that tell you about whether the city has really been looking hard enough to find partners?
I would say the answer to that question is definitely no. And I think that, you know, despite, you know, how Pollyanna-ish I sounded a few minutes ago about the progress that's been made, I would take your point that it's really insufficient given the length of time that people have noted the need to include you know, more diversity in city contracting and our legislative bodies and so forth. And so I would say that the city probably hasn't been trying hard enough. And I think what institutions have to do is they have to, build on ramps for businesses that have not historically competed for these or even been considered to compete in the public contracting arena to help them become certified, help them navigate the processes and procedures, obviously, this assistance should be available to any contractor who wants to take advantage of it. But I think that educational role of government could really improve the situation a lot. And I just don't see that that's been happening necessarily.
Renee, then what are you looking for in, say, the coming months? Because we expect that Marty Walsh will ultimately go to Washington as the next labor secretary. He seemed to do fine in his confirmation hearings. And if he does, Kim Janey will become the acting mayor. And as the city council president, this sort of city contracting reform has been, you know, one of her issues. But she's going to end up, if she's in the mayor's side, sort of, you know, having to defend the city in this lawsuit. What are you watching there? It's a strange dynamic.
Well, it is a strange dynamic, but, she could also, take some steps to agree to settle the case, institute some new programs and new ideas about how to solve this issue and make it much more of a priority that could perhaps lead to settling the case on a constructive path to making progress. Without disavowing, what's happened in the past. Because the remedy is the forward. The remedy in a case like this is what are you going to do in the future?
What did you make of the second Senate acquittal of former President Donald Trump? What do you think the future of both parties are, and how will Massachusetts politicians fit into that picture? What would you like to see from our leaders? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jim, Renee, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said this week that a 9/11 style commission is going to investigate the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Jim, what are your hopes and expectations for that probe?
Look, I think it's great if we find out exactly who went in. I think we've learned a lot of that. I'd like to know who strategized behind getting in, who helped in preparation. It's more the preparation side of it that really interests me to understand what the networks are.
And Renee, what are you looking for?
I would agree with that. And also, what kinds of measures need to be taken in the agencies that are responsible for security of public buildings and public officials so that the decisions about the level of security cannot be overridden. Or politicized in a way that obviously, could have been, what led to tragic consequences because five people's deaths are attributed to that event, but could have resulted in serious harm to some of our very senior public officials.
Sure. And the formation of this commission comes after the second impeachment acquittal of former President Donald Trump. So a lot of people are wondering what should happen to him next. Well, we spoke with Congressman Jake Auchincloss on Radio Boston this week, and he told us that he's not actually ready for Congress to just move on.
We need to pass a joint resolution that lays out the facts of what happened on January 6th, the President Trump's role in it. And of course, the impeachment proceedings have made it easier to lay out those facts. And then concluding that the third section of the 14th Amendment disqualifies President Trump from holding office in the future.
So, Renee, I mean, you're a lawyer. I don't know if you have an opinion on Auchincloss's legal analysis of the 14th Amendment there. But what do you think should happen to Trump?
Well, he has a lot of company in the legal profession who agree that analysis is possible. And the advantage that it has in over the impeachment process is that it doesn't require a supermajority vote in both houses in order to accomplish the goal. It's not clear to me that there necessarily are sufficient Democratic votes to accomplish that, but he's the one who's more in a position to count the heads than I am. But I do think that one of the unfortunate consequences of the impeachment acquittal is that there will be people, as Jim alluded to, who probably will be going to prison and suffer other serious consequences in the criminal justice system because of their actions at the Capitol. And I'm not shedding too many tears for them, because they were grownups and they made their own determinations to engage in those unlawful activities. But it would be another unfairness in our very unfair criminal justice system if they were the only people held accountable. And as Jim said, not the people who perhaps engaged in some of the strategizing about it, and the president and other members of Congress who allowed them to believe that this was an appropriate response to their disappointment with the outcome of the election. And I think that people have to bear the consequences of instilling that idea and encouraging people to go to extremes to act on their disappointment.
So we'll see whether Congress does pursue any further action against the former president. But in the meantime, congressional Democrats do seem to have largely turned their attention to the passing of another coronavirus stimulus package. And one of the many things that many of them want to do is raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. And on this show, Senator Elizabeth Warren made the case for it.
The $15 an hour minimum wage across the board is going to help not only lift millions of families out of poverty, it's also going to help boost our economy overall. I'm going to be putting a big push on for that $15 an hour minimum wage. It's long past time.
So that's Warren's take. Folks, if you want to chime in with your analysis of the minimum wage or something else in national politics, the number again is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. But Jim Sturgis, let me come to you on that first. I mean, your think tank is in the business of analyzing policy ideas like this one. Do you agree with the senator?
Well, I guess the first thing is it's not going to happen. I think we already know that politically. That's the conversation within the White House is pointing to not pushing on this one. But what I would say is I think it can be a good thing in some instances. It can be a bad thing in some instances. And it's been largely left to states for that very reason. Our state has decided to, over a number of years, raise the minimum wage to $15. I would guess that in a place that has a lower set of salary ranges, it may not be that helpful. So it's probably not something I think is best done through federal legislation.
All right. It's not the only major sort of economic policy on the table. I want to get your take on this one, Renee Landers. But to set it up, I want to hear first from Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who has the idea. She unveiled another proposal. It's sort of related to raising the minimum wage, but her idea is that everybody has the right to employment at a livable wage.
I will formally introduce a congressional resolution calling for a federal job guarantee. A federal job guarantee would address the current unemployment crisis, make our economy more resilient, begin closing the racial and gender income gaps, and lay the foundation for a truly just and equitable economic recovery.
So, Renee, these things kind of go hand in hand. She's talking about a job guarantee there. We heard Senator Warren a moment ago talking about the $15 minimum wage. What's your take?
Well, I think what unites the two approaches is an effort to increase the incomes of some of the low-income populations in the country to make their economic status more secure, less vulnerable to these crises and disruptions in the economy that occur. And I think that along with some proposals by, our former Governor Romney about, a childcare, making childcare payments to families. All of these things are aimed at making sure that people, who have family responsibilities and who work hard are able to have a reasonable standard of living in our country. In our country, I think I agree with Senator Warren and Congresswoman Pressley that our country is wealthy enough to sustain that.
All right, let's squeeze in one more call, at least, before we have to say goodbye this week. Tom is in Rutland. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, I was saying I don't understand why people are concerned about impeachment or the 14th Amendment or criminal charges. People could sue Donald Trump civilly. He maintained control of his property, so he made an active decision to that could benefit from his actions as president. He's committed misfeasance, and it would be really easy to draw a direct line of causation between that and loss of benefit, you know, benefits of society as a public, you know, sue him as a public nuisance, like with the opiate epidemic. I'm sure he'd be more concerned about loss of money, billions of dollars in a civil lawsuit, than he would be with criminal charges.
Got it, Tom. Thanks for the ring. And I mean, yeah, it's a valid question. In fact, we have seen a lawsuit just this week. Mississippi Congressman Benny Thompson is part of an expected wave of litigation related to the January 6th insurrection. So we could see some more of that. I'm curious, though, Jim Sturgis, what your take is on what that kind of fallout could mean for the GOP, because you see this sort of splintering right now. Who's going to stay loyal to the former president? Who's going to break away? Renee Landers a moment ago brought up our former governor Mitt Romney. We have other moderates in the picture like Susan Collins and, of course, our current governor Charlie Baker. I mean, are they the future of the GOP, or do you think that this Trump faction is going to hold on to power?
I have no idea.
I appreciate the honesty.
I have no idea. I honestly, I'm far less interested in politics than most people, so I really have no idea. And I've, from the beginning of the Trump administration, to be quite honest, I've made it a practice to let others speak about him simply because I have little to say about people who are inconsistent and loudmouths. I don't know what to say about them.
All right. Well, fair enough. Renee, let me just ask sort of a twist on that question for you about what you think about Democrats, because you have Joe Biden as the president who won in what I think most would call the more moderate lane of the Democratic Party. But he does have the pull of progressives from the left to move the party farther in that direction. Do you see the Democratic coalition holding over the next few years?
I actually do, and I think that it's in the country's interest that it actually hold together, because I think, you know, Jim mentioned earlier, you know, needing the necessity of getting the economy back on the right path and getting, you know, people reemployed, you know, and having their incomes restored. One way to do that, to jumpstart that process, is for Congress to pass this next round of pandemic relief so that there is money flowing into the economy, that people can continue to do the things they usually do and that they need to do. And so I think that the Democrats need to be motivated by a record of accomplishments of accomplishment over the next year and a half, because otherwise, I think they won't have anything to show when the time comes for the midterm elections in 2022.
It feels like the political cycle never ends. We got a big time mayor's race in Boston this year. We've got a governor's race next year. Of course, we'll have the midterms, as you say. And then, you know, 2024 will be here before we know it. Jim Sturgis, Renee Landers, it has been a lot of fun spending the day with you. We have plenty more to keep talking about next week, and Radio Boston will be here to cover it all. That's Jim Sturgis from the Pioneer Institute. Thanks again for your time.
Good to be with you.
Renee Landers from Suffolk University, thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much. It was a good discussion.
And that's all the time we have. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman, with help from Stephen Gelman. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal, and our executive producer is Sitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.